The Roman Catholic Church claims that Peter is the first pope. So in this second session, I want us to discuss the origin of the papacy. If the church is built on Peter, and there's an unbroken line from Peter down to the present, then I submit to you, all churches ought to join with the Roman Catholic Church. If, however, that is not true, then the problem is, well, when did the Roman Catholic Church start? How did it start? And what about that passage in Matthew that where Jesus says, on this rock I build my church, and sounds like he's talking about Peter. What do you do with all of that? Well, those are some of the questions I would like to attempt to answer in this session. Let's begin by just an explanation of what the Catholic Church says. And then, as in the first session, we will examine that from a biblical and historical point of view. So let's begin in Matthew chapter 16 and look at that infamous passage where Jesus said, upon this rock I will build my church. It's in Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, where he says, I say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Now, as you've heard, I'm sure, the Greek word for Peter means rock. And so the Catholic Church says that Jesus is pointing to Peter and says, you are Peter, you're the rock, and on this rock, meaning Peter, I will build my church. So, Peter is the rock. The church is built on the rock, therefore the church is built on Peter. That's the logic. In St. Peter's Basilica, which is in the center of the Vatican in Rome, there is a dome, and around the dome is printed this verse. This is the foundation of the Catholic Church. They would argue beyond this verse that if you just look at the New Testament, Peter is obviously the leader. That he, above all the other apostles, is the one who leads them. And then they would say that he is the first bishop of Rome. Now that is a very important phrase. Technically, if you listen carefully even to the news when they talk about the Pope, they will call him the Bishop of Rome. He wears several hats, if you'll permit me to put it that way. But the first and foremost issue is that he is the bishop of Rome. They will further argue that being the bishop of Rome from 42 to 67 AD makes him the first pope in Rome. So, the position of the Roman Catholic Church is that the church is built on a rock, which is Peter, and that Peter was in Rome from 42 to 67 AD, and therefore he's the first, not just bishop of Rome, but the first pope. Now that's their case. The question is it biblical? Or after all, this series is talking about a biblical look at the Catholic Church. So let's start with this verse. Is their interpretation of it correct? And you can imagine I'm going to say no. Well, in light of what the verse says, how can you say that's not the interpretation of the verse? And the answer is this. The word Peter does mean rock. But when Jesus says, thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, he uses two distinct different words. Now I'm going to have to teach you a little Greek. The Greek word for Peter is Petros. And the Greek word where he says, and upon this rock I'll build my church, is Petre. They sound similar, but they are radically different. The word Peter, Petros, is referring to a smaller kind of rock. But when you say Petre, you're talking about a big boulder. Do you remember in the Sermon on the Mount when Jesus said, wise man built his house on a rock and the foolish man built his house on a sand? The word for rock in Matthew chapter 7 is Petre. This rock is so big you can build a house on it. So Jesus is, in a sense, doing a play on words, but he's not saying, I'm going to build the house on Peter. He's saying the very opposite. I'm going to build the house on a rock that's a whole lot bigger than Peter. Well, there's another issue. I just told you the Greek words for rock in this passage. Let me explain further that the one translated Peter is in the Greek language in the masculine gender. We don't have gender in English like they do in Greek or Spanish or other languages as well. But in Greek, on a noun, there's a gender. By the words that appear at the end, you know the gender of the word. Peter is a masculine word. Petrae is feminine. There is no way this word could possibly refer to the Apostle Peter because it is feminine. So there's a different word and a different gender. But look at the verse. The verse says, upon this rock I will build my church, and the gate of Hades, I said hell when I read the verse a minute ago, same difference, shall not prevail against it. Now think for a second. Did Satan prevail against Peter? That's testing your knowledge of the New Testament. The answer is yes. Remember Jesus said, Satan is going to sift you, and Satan won. Satan prevailed against him. And then says, when you're restored, go feed my sheep. So, all kinds of things in this verse indicate that it could not possibly refer to the Apostle Peter. Now let me go one step further. If you will remember in the first session, I pointed out that at the Council of Trent, they sanctioned believing in tradition. Remember that? You didn't forget that already, did you? And they defined tradition as the unanimous agreement of the early church fathers. Remember that? Well, let's apply their rule to this verse. Did the church fathers say that Peter here was the rock? Well, some of them did, but by no means was that unanimous. For example, 44 said that it was the confession of Peter. 17 said it was Peter. 16 said it was Jesus. And later in the New Testament, he's called a rock, by the way. And 8 said it applied to all of the apostles. Now, that's far from unanimous. So even by the rule of interpretation that the Catholic Church itself sets down, this verse does not pass their test. Peter is not the rock. Well, what is it? And the answer is, it's in the feminine. And the only thing I think it can possibly refer to, and I'm not alone in this by any stretch of the imagination, is the confession that Peter just made. For Jesus said, who do men say that I am? And verse 16, Peter said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus said to him, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood did not reveal that to you. My Father who is in heaven, and I say to you, you're Peter, but upon this rock, meaning the confession of faith that you just made as to who I am. The church is not built on a person. The church is built on a profession of faith in Jesus Christ. So, this verse is not saying that Peter is the basis or the foundation of the church. Matter of fact, he goes on to say in verse 19, I give you the keys of the kingdom, and whatsoever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatsoever you bind on earth shall be loosed, and so forth. He gives that same authority to everybody, all the apostles. In chapter 18, verse 18, he said, assuredly I say to you, and this time the word is in the plural, whatsoever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatsoever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. So this is not just given to Peter as a person. It is, some of this is given to the other apostles as well. Well, what about that stuff concerning the fact that he was a leader in the New Testament? Well, that's true. Peter was a leader. That's very clear. But Peter was not the Pope. I mentioned last time that in Galatians chapter 6, Paul called him down to the face, withstood him to the face. So if he was the Pope, he got corrected by Paul. And then in Acts 15, which is the Jerusalem Council, it's even more significant, it seems to me, because they had to make a decision, and they didn't turn to the Pope and say, what's the answer? They voted, and Peter was simply one who had to argue his case like all the rest. But let me tell you what Peter said about himself. Did he think he was a Pope? Turn to 1 Peter chapter 1. Peter wrote a letter. Well, how did he identify himself? Well, look at 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 1. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ. Now turn to chapter 5. The elders who are among you, I exhort, I who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and a partaker of the glory that will be revealed. We don't know how Peter thought of himself. Turn to 2 Peter. Look at chapter 1, verse 1. Simon Peter, a bondslave, a slave of Jesus Christ, and an apostle as well. So here's Peter's identification. I'm an apostle just like 11 other guys. And I'm an elder. I think if you look carefully at the New Testament, you will see that the apostles faded out of the picture and they turned the work of the church over to elders. So Peter gets down to the end of his life. This is written just before he dies. And he says, look, don't look at me as an apostle. I'm an elder. So he did not go up the ladder of authority. He went down the ladder of authority and ends up calling himself a slave and a fellow elder. All right. What then about history? What happened after the New Testament? And oh, does this get interesting? Remember I told you a moment ago they claimed that he was in Rome from 42 to 67? That didn't happen. We know from the New Testament it didn't happen. Paul wrote to the church at Rome in 57. In chapter 16, he calls people by name. Peter is absent. His name is not in the list. He wrote Colossians in 61 from Rome. And in chapter 4, he lists a number of people that says, greetings to you, and Peter is not in the list. Both of those indicate Peter was not in Rome. Can you imagine Peter being in Rome and Paul not mentioning him in Romans or Colossians? That didn't happen. He wrote 2 Timothy from Rome in 67. And he says, only Luke is with me. So, church history does not support the contention of the Catholic Church that Peter was in Rome for 25 years as the first bishop and therefore the first pope. It just can't be proven. In preparation for all of this, I not only read a number of books, I listened to some lectures. As a matter of fact, you know how you can get books on tape? You can get lectures on tape. And so I bought some lectures from the professor of history at Notre Dame University, probably the most prestigious Catholic university, most well known at least, in the United States, right? Well, he teaches there. His name is Noble. And I listened to his lectures on the history of the papacy. And when he gets to this issue, he says this: it is unlikely that Peter was in Rome from 42 to 67, because Peter was in Antioch and Corinth during that time, and in 49 he was in Jerusalem. Furthermore, and I'm going to quote him word for word, Peter did not found the Roman community, and there is no good evidence that the community had a bishop, an overseer, in the first century. End of quote. Now that's a professor from Notre Dame talking, not me. I do not think you can prove that Peter was in Rome from 42 to 67. As a matter of fact, I'm rather confident that you can't. So, I do not think Peter was the first pope. The Bible and early church history support that. And I would argue, even a professor from Notre Dame acknowledges that the evidence that they claim isn't accurate. Well, if that's the case, where did the papacy come from? Where did the pope start it? Who was the first pope? And what do you mean by pope anyway? All right, I'm going to answer that, and it's going to be a little detailed. I don't expect you to remember everything I'm going to say from this point on. I doubt that you remember everything I've said thus far. But I want you to get the impression. Here is my thesis. It is my opinion that the papacy evolved. And I learned this by simply reading church history. So what I'm going to do is walk through the first 6 centuries of the history of Christianity and show you how the concept of a pope evolved. That's my thesis. All right, let's start with the New Testament itself. Turn to Titus chapter 1. Titus chapter 1. If you know anything at all about the New Testament, you know that they had elders, plural, in every church, singular. James says, if anybody's sick, let him call the elders, plural, from the church, singular. Acts says something similar. They ordained elders, plural, in every church. It's in Acts 14. Now, every church in the New Testament had a group of elders. Now look at Titus chapter 1, verse 5. Paul says to Titus, I left you in Crete that you should set in order the things that are lacking and appoint elders. Wow. They didn't get elected? Nope. He appointed them. That's interesting. In every city as I have commanded you. So Titus was to establish these little churches and appoint elders. Keep reading. If any man is blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of disputation and insubordination, for a bishop must be... Whoa, whoa, whoa. Did you slide over that too quick? What did he say?
Bishop.
Bishop. I thought you said go appoint elders. He did. And then he calls elders bishop. This passage and some others clearly demonstrate that in the New Testament, an elder and a bishop was the same person. It's the same person with two different names. Elder probably talked about his age. They were older men. And bishop means overseer. That describes their job. They were to have the oversight of these congregations to see to it that the word of God was taught and that false doctrine was not taught. So, this is very important. An elder in the New Testament is called a bishop. There were a plurality of those in the church, and they were from the church to be over it. And they were equal. One was probably the leader, like Titus or Timothy, but they were equal. The bishop wasn't over the elders. He was one of the elders, as Titus 1 proves. Now, about the time the New Testament was completed, 95 AD, we have a man named Clement of Rome who wrote a letter to the church at Corinth. The church at Corinth was having all kinds of problems, just like they were when Paul wrote them decades before. They were divided. And Clement in Rome wrote to the church in Corinth and said, don't do that. Some young bucks were trying to depose the elders. Now, what we learn from what is called First Clement is that the church at Corinth in 95 AD had a plurality of elders in the church, just like the New Testament says they should. Then there's a book called the Didache, which simply means teaching. There's some debate over when the date of that is because we don't know. I've come to the conclusion that it's real early because of things that are said in it. Maybe even as early as 90 AD, a scholar writing an article about that convinced me that he had a lot of good evidence to support that. It's early, for sure, and it indicates that there were elders in each church. Then there was a man named Polycarp, who wrote about 110 AD, and we know from his writings that the churches had a plurality of elders. So from the New Testament and from the time shortly after that, it's very clear that God established elders to have the oversight in a church. Then the plot thickens. Then there are writings by a guy named Ignatius. And apparently he wrote about 116. And he indicates that there were churches where the bishop was over the elders. Now that is different. That's a departure from what's in the New Testament. So, how did that happen? That would sort of be like saying that a church today had a pastor and a board, and the pastor was over the board. There are churches like that, you know. Not biblical, but that would sort of be the idea. Now, the point I'm making is the bishop was over the elders, but the bishop wasn't over a number of churches. He was over the elders in that church. That's all. So what's happened now, shortly after the time of the New Testament, is that the bishop has been elevated over the elders. That's step one in the wrong direction. Say, wow, boy, that's awfully close to the New Testament. Matter of fact, some argue that's so close to the New Testament, that must be what the New Testament's talking about. Well, those who say that don't read the New Testament with both eyes open, or for that matter, with even one eye open. But that shouldn't surprise you. It shouldn't surprise you that one somebody is going to say, I'm in charge. Just read the New Testament. Look at 3 John verse 9, where John says, I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loved to have the preeminence among them, does not receive us. Even in New Testament times, late in the first century, already we have a man who is becoming the dictator, so much so that he won't receive the Apostle John, or at least his letter. John says, when I come, I'll straighten that out. So, it shouldn't surprise you that somebody decided that they had more authority than everybody else in a church. Boy, doesn't that sound familiar? All right. Some would like to do that, even if they don't. Now, The next thing that happens late in the second century. It's about 185. There were some people who claimed, well, you're just going by what the apostles said. And the apostles mixed some other ideas with what Jesus taught. So some church fathers, that is, some Christian leaders, stood up and said, no, that's not what happened at all. Irenaeus is one of them, Tertullian is another, and they argued that the apostles appointed bishops, another word for that is elders, and those elders appointed other elders, and so it wasn't that long ago that we had elders appointed by the elders, and we know these elders are teaching what the apostles taught. So this is the first hint of something like apostolic succession. But the apostolic succession is not of apostolic authority. Nobody's claiming apostolic authority. They're claiming apostolic teaching. And that happened late in the second century. So here's the point. In the first century, you've got elders over a church. From within the church, they're elders over the church. In the second century, one of the elders becomes a bishop over that individual church, and the claim is starting to be made, and they go all the way back to the apostles in their teaching. The next thing that happened is that these bishops started getting together. So we go from the establishment of the elders and the elevation of bishop to the election of an archbishop. I told you this is going to get a little complicated. Let me keep it simple. Elders, bishop, archbishop. How did we get to archbishop? Well, simply, they had a pastor's meeting. All the pastors got together. Now, let's see if I can illustrate this. The Roman Empire had 54 provinces. The state of California has 58 counties. So I'm going to use the whole state of California as an illustration of the whole Roman Empire. Got it? Got it. All right. We're going to make their counties Roman provinces. So all in the world that happened at the beginning is that all the bishops, we would say today something like pastors, had a pastor's meeting. So all those in Los Angeles County got together. All those in San Bernardino County got together. And all those in Riverside County got together. And all throughout the Roman Empire. So they had little pastor's meetings. And then they decided to have regional meetings. So we live in Los Angeles County, but this is part of the region called Southern California. And there's Central California, Northern California. You can divide and the Roman Empire was divided up like that. So then they had regional meetings. And when they had regional meetings, they would meet in the biggest city in the region. So if San Bernardino County and Riverside County and Los Angeles County and all the pastors decide to have a meeting, where would they meet? Los Angeles, right? We'd meet in the big place. So they then elected one of these bishops to preside. It's as simple as that. And he became known as a metropolitan bishop. He was now a bishop that was over other bishops, and hence the word archbishop. But he was called a metropolitan first, and then he was called an archbishop. So we go from elder to bishop, and now we got a bishop over bishops called a archbishop. And they met in the major metropolitan areas, and that's why they were called metropolitans. As a matter of fact, to really appreciate what's going on, you have to remember sort of the way the Roman Empire was organized. The major metropolitan areas were Alexandria in Egypt, Antioch, which was a major city, and of course, Rome. Now, here's what happened. As a result of the organization of the Roman Empire, Alexander, Antioch were chief cities in the east, so that the bishop of Alexandria became sort of the chief bishop in Egypt. The bishop in Antioch sort of became the chief bishop of the rest of the bishops in the east, including Asia Minor, Greece, and Syria. Then the bishop in Rome became sort of the chief bishop in the west. So at this point, there were three archbishops. I'm going to say it. Big cheeses. And to really appreciate how that works, you have to be a pastor that goes to pastors' meetings. And one pastor is going to stick out his chest and be big cheese. So, to use my California illustration, at this point we got three big cheeses. We got one from Los Angeles, one from San Francisco, and one from, let's say, San Diego. All right? These are the biggest. By the way, that really is the way it works. I once pastored a church in downtown Los Angeles, a very well-known all over the world church, a very historic church. And as pastor of that church, I went to Korea to preach, and so did a bunch of other preachers. And we're sitting at lunch and going around the table, where are you from, where are you from, where are you from? And I said, Los Angeles. He said, oh, what church do you pastor? I said, Church of the Open Door. And everybody at the table said, you are the pastor of the Church of the Open Door? Yeah. Do you know about the Church of the Open Door? It was pastored by R.A. Torrey and Louis Talbot and J. Vernon McGee. You're the pastor of that church? Yeah. You know? I instantaneously got elevated. Trust me. That's the way it works. I wasn't trying. I just told them where I was from, what church I pastored. But in their eyes, he's from Los Angeles. Everybody at that table was duly impressed. That's the way this happened. Exactly the way this happened. All right, so we got three archbishops. The next thing that happens is we're going to make one of these more important than the other two. Sound reasonable? Now, we're going to go down to about 250 A.D. In 250 A.D., there was a bishop, a pastor, named Cyprian, who was a bishop of Carthage. And he emphasized that the bishop was important to keep unity in the church. And he gave the earliest formation of the doctrine of apostolic succession. And what he did is he said this, you know, since that bishop at Rome is in the same place where Peter was, well, we ought to give him more honor. And at that point, that's all it was, the primacy of honor, not authority. Just because he's in Rome, we ought to give him more honor. But he clearly said, all bishops are equal. He insisted that no bishop should, and I'm quoting him, set himself up as a bishop of bishops. Now, isn't that interesting? We're going to give the guy in Rome a little more honor, but he's just one of us. He's just an equal among us. The bishop of Rome deserved special honor because he was in the line of succession from Peter. But no bishop had administrative authority over any other bishop. We're just going to give him a little more honor. Now, about that same time, there was a bishop in Rome itself named Stephen who decided that he was worthy of all that authority. The bishop of Rome was the successor of Peter, and he sort of claimed that. Now, there's a vast difference between that and what's going to become the idea of a pope. But at this point, that's what happened. Now, I mentioned a moment ago the professor at Notre Dame University. At this point in his lectures, he says, there's a distinction between Peter the person, the Petrine idea of some kind of an office, and the institution of the papacy. He claims that this Stephen the First, who was the Bishop of Rome from 254 to 257, insisted that he held the chair of Peter in succession to Peter. And so, according to the professor, this assertion inaugurated the idea that each pope is Peter's successor. But he said, I'm talking about the professor now, that there's a huge difference between Peter the person and this idea now that Peter held some kind of an office. And he goes, the professor at Notre Dame says, the idea of this whole thing of a tradition concerning Peter the person cannot be proven. But the idea that there was this Petrine idea of an office that Peter held sort of, according to him, took root in 254 A.D. Now, again, I want to emphasize, this is not a position of authority over other bishops. That idea develops later, which I'm going to talk about, but it's not yet. The city of Rome, I think, was a contributing factor to this idea because it was the capital of the Roman Empire. And Christians would have naturally had some honor for Rome. Paul wrote his longest letter to Rome. The earliest persecution of Christians was by Nero in Rome. It wasn't empire-wide, it was just Rome. Both Peter and Paul were martyred in Rome. First Clement, that letter was written from Rome. So, it was sort of natural that Rome should get all the prestige, so to speak. All right, that's 250. Now we're going to jump to 325. In 325, there was the Council of Nicaea, one of the most famous events in all of church history because they decided that Jesus was deity at the Council of Nicaea. But they did something else. They prioritized the bishop. And they decided that the three great centers were Rome, Alexandria, and Antioch. And they, for the first time, they prioritized them. And they said, oh yeah, we'll throw in Jerusalem. Then, in 330, Constantine moved the capital from Rome to Constantinople. So now we've got two, well, we've only got one, but we got, Rome is no longer the capital of the empire. Constantinople is. So, he made it second after Rome. As a matter of fact, the Council of Constantinople in 381 went back and altered that priority list that was established by the Council of Nicaea in 325. And here's what they said. We're going to make Rome first and Constantinople second. And then will come Alexander. So all of a sudden now, in the fourth century, we're prioritizing these things and we're very strict about it. It's an official decision of an official council as to which bishop is priority, more important. The acceptance of equality among the bishops was still there. There's a priority of honor. Maybe we give some primacy to the Bishop of Rome because of all that tradition, but they're still equal. That started to break down around 395. It was that year that the Roman Empire split into two empires, the East and the West. The Western Empire was ruled from Rome, and the Eastern Empire was ruled from Constantinople. And now, remember I told you about all these bishops we got? Most of them are in the East. Alexandria, Constantinople, Antioch, Jerusalem. They're all in the East. That only leaves one in the West. And he's where? In Rome. So, in 402, Innocent I, Bishop of Rome, made it a rule that no important decision could be made by the church in the West without the knowledge and the approval of the Bishop of Rome. So now, being the authority in the Western Empire, gave the Bishop of Rome even more authority. He's still not over all the other bishops yet, but more authority. Then in 451, it really starts to get interesting. They established something called patriarchs. Now remember I told you that we had local meetings, the city of Los Angeles, city of San Bernardino, city of Riverside, and then we had regional meetings. Well, now we're going to establish patriarchs who exercise authority over something wider than just the county, maybe several counties put together. And they came up with five jurisdictions that held particular honor, and an order of precedence was established among them. Here they are. Now, this is 451, and now we're going to establish five jurisdictions, and we're going to give these people the name patriarchs. So we've gone from elder to bishop to archbishop, metropolitan, and now we're going to have a patriarch. And here are the five: Rome, Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem. By the way, they left out, these five then had jurisdiction over the whole Roman Empire, but they left out Cyprus. It was the whole known world except Cyprus, and it was granted independence. And till this day, the church in Cyprus is independent. It was never part of the Roman church. So all five patriarchs shared equally in apostolic succession. We're just going to give them some more honor. So, to use my California illustration, we're going to have five patriarchs: San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Sacramento, and Oakland. See how my thesis is this evolved? Can you just imagine how that evolved? And we're going to exalt Sacramento because it's the capital. And in the case of Rome, it's because, well, Peter was there. Now, we've seen he wasn't. He died there, that's true. But he wasn't there for 25 years, and he wasn't the bishop of Rome. There's no evidence for that whatsoever. But that becomes the tradition. So, until 450, all bishops are equal in rank, power, and function. And then came along a fella named Leo the First, called Leo the Great. He was the bishop in Rome, and he began to claim supremacy over other bishops. Did you catch that? That's new. For the first time, we've got a bishop who's claiming that he has supremacy over all other bishops. Now, this gets real interesting. The Council of Chalcedon in 451 gave Constantinople jurisdiction over Asia Minor. That's modern-day Istanbul over Turkey. That's all that amounts to. Well, Leo said, no way. I don't accept that. And then he made this statement: Peter speaks through Leo. Now, he's claiming something that has never been claimed before. One professor says, Leo saw himself as Peter's successor, but at this point the claim was jurisdictional rather than doctrinal. Now we're claiming authority. Well, let me just tell you, there was at the time a theological controversy, and I'm not going to bore you with all of that, except to say that at the Council of Ephesus, they excommunicated Leo. So if Leo was a pope got excommunicated. Now that got turned around, and he ended up getting reinstated, but I just thought it was interesting that he got excommunicated. Leo's opinion was not generally accepted. In that theological controversy, just because the Bishop of Rome said it didn't settle it. Matter of fact, it got settled, and it got settled on his side of the street, but that was because of a lot of other factors and was not because he said it. Matter of fact, one historian said, Leo was able to exercise authority in the city of Rome due to his personal gifts and the political situation at the time, when civil authorities proved incapable of performing their duties. But Leo was convinced that Jesus made Peter and his successor the rock on which the church was built, and therefore the Bishop of Rome was Peter's direct successor and head of the church. Peter's writings contain all the traditional arguments that were repeated after that in favor of papal authority. So, some people, based on that, claim that Leo was the first pope, and he's the first to act like a pope. In my opinion, he's not the first pope. We'll get to that right now, but he's the first to start talking about that. All right, who became the first pope? What does that mean? Well, the word pope isn't in the Bible. The word pope simply means father. By the way, in Matthew chapter 23, Jesus said, don't call any man father. But they did it anyway. They did it for centuries. All priests were called popes. And in some traditions, they are still called popes. The pope in Rome is not the only pope, and certainly not the only father. Eventually, however, the word pope came to be used exclusively of the Bishop of Rome as the universal bishop. Now, if you've tracked me so far, you've heard me say over and over, they were considered equal. No more. Now we've got a universal bishop. In that sense, the first pope was Gregory the First. And the way he got to be pope is really interesting. There was an emperor in the west, in Rome, who had a conflict with the emperor in the east, in Constantinople. So the emperor in the east excommunicated wanted to kick out the emperor in the east. And so, to spite him, he made the Bishop of Rome the universal bishop. That man was Gregory the First, called Gregory the Great. He didn't accept the title. He was given it, but he didn't accept it. This, by the way, was in the year 604. And the next man who came after him, Boniface, did accept it. And that is the first pope. Now let me add something here. The pope is called the pontifice. You ever heard that word? Of course. It comes from two Latin words that mean bridge and builder. It's the bridge builder. In ancient Rome, it was the pagan emperor who assumed that title as the high priest of all the religions in Rome. And it meant that he built the bridge between this life and the next life. So it's a pagan term. This has been said over and over again. So the bishop at Rome accepted Pontifex Maximus. In other words, he took that pagan title and applied it to himself. One professor, a guy named Cook, who is a Roman Catholic, he's a professor in State University of New York, says this, and I quote, bishops, quote, took up the trappings of pagan Rome, such as the Bishop of Rome's use of the title Pontifex Maximus, end of quote. So that's not some Protestant going after Catholics. It's a Catholic professor saying that's what happened. All right. Have I confused you enough? I told you there's a lot of material. Here's my thesis. It evolved. Started out with a plurality of elders. Then one bishop got over to be over the elders. Then we got an archbishop, and then we got a patriarch, and then we got a pope. That's the whole thing in a nutshell. I am of the opinion the Roman Catholic Church did not start until 605 AD. 604, I keep saying 605. There is a Protestant professor of the Free Church in Edinburgh who says, quote, Gregory, brilliant role, set a standard for those who came after him, and he is really the first pope, end of quote. Philip Hughes, a Roman Catholic, says, quote, in a very real sense, he, Gregory I, is the founder of the papal monarch. So in my California illustration, we end up with the biggest cheese of all is in Sacramento, because he is in the capital. Got it? All right. Peter was not the first pope. Peter was not a pope at all. The idea of a pope evolved. First there was elders, then there were bishops, archbishops, patriarchs, and finally a pope. If you get just that much down, you have the point. Now, I want to conclude by saying a couple of things. One is this. What distinguishes the Catholic Church from all other churches? They believe in seven sacraments. Is that what makes them different? No. Because Orthodox churches believe in the seven sacraments. We're going to get to that later. How about the doctrine of transubstantiation? Does that make them different? No. The Orthodox churches believe in transubstantiation. Well, what about the fact that they have a pope? That does not make them distinctive. The church in Egypt has a pope. What makes the Roman Catholic Church distinctive is they have a Roman pope. So it is accurately called the Roman Catholic Church. Therefore, that idea was not until 604, and therefore, the Roman Catholic Church is the church headed by a pope in Rome, and therefore, the founding of the Roman Catholic Church is in 604 A.D. All right. I began this series last time talking about myself. As a child, I got the impression that the Catholic Church was the original church and therefore the true church. And every time I passed one, I thought, what if they're right? Now, how do you decide that question? Well, I want to conclude by telling you how I decided this question. I started comparing the Catholic Church to what the New Testament teaches. And that passage in Matthew really helped me. When I understood that passage, then I understood that the Catholic Church is not built on Peter. That really helped. But I have a confession to make. Impressions made in your childhood die hard. And I think a lot of people who grow up in the Catholic Church, whose family is in the Catholic Church, who's attended the Catholic Church all their life, will have a hard time accepting what I've just spelled out. I don't think there's any question. I mean, the material I'm presenting, you can go Google and find it out. I mean, there's nothing special about this. I've quoted Catholic professors that agree with it. So the issue comes down to, are you going to accept the scripture? Are you going to accept an idea that isn't based in either scripture or history? Which is it going to be? Well, even though I had Matthew straightened out, it still bothered me. Until one day, somebody shared with me a verse in 1 John. 1 John Chapter 3, verse 20 says, "If our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart." That verse liberated me. And I said, wow, am I going to listen to my heart that keeps saying, what if they're right? What if they're right? Or am I going to take God at His word?
Amen.
Let's pray. Father, thank you for giving us the truth. The truth about your church, how it's to be governed. The truth about salvation, how we're to obtain it. Father, equip us to be workmen that need not be ashamed because we rightly divide the word of truth. In Jesus' name, amen.